Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hewlett-Packard says it got scammed to the tune of $9 billion. We have a chat with CEO Meg Whitman straight ahead. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 20th of November. Good to have you with us. Hewlett-Packard, one of the grand old names of American high tech, reported quarterly profits today. They were lousy, but that's not really the headline. The company had to take a nearly $9 billion write-off on an acquisition it made a year ago. HP says it thinks somebody was cooking the books at Autonomy, and it's asked the SEC to look into things. To make matters worse, HP is trying to find its way in a high-tech world that is rapidly moving past just printers and PCs. Meg Whitman is the CEO of Hewlett-Packard. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So how's your day going so far?
It's all right.
Oh, you're fibbing me. Come on.
Yeah, a lot of announcements at Hewlett-Packard today.
Well, let's talk about the big one, right? This Autonomy loss. You were on the board of HP at the time. You were not the CEO, but you were on the board. Where does responsibility lie within HP for this? One can only call it a disaster.
So, HP's board is very disappointed. We feel terrible about this. I'm sorry I voted for this acquisition. But what I will tell you is we relied on audited financial statements by Deloitte, which is not exactly brand X auditor, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very well-known company. And who would have dreamed that, that the financial reports did not have integrity as we expected?
Bad as this was, is it possible that the bigger problem with HP is not this fraud, but the fact that revenue in all of your major divisions was declining, that you guys practically would have lost money anyway?
Oh, well, we did not practically lose money anyway. We generated $10.6 billion worth of operating cash flow, which is more cash flow than companies like Visa, Disney, FedEx, et cetera, earn. So actually, we are generating a lot of cash at this company.
You have talked in the fairly recent past about wanting to get HP back to where it started, that is, innovating and driving things in the world of high tech. I wonder, though, if innovation is not going to come from PCs as it doesn't in the world today, or printers as it hasn't in HP for a long time, where will that innovation at your company come from? What are you going to do?
You know, first of all, some people say, HP doesn't have much innovation left. I would say quite the opposite now, having been the CEO for a year. And innovation is alive and well at HP. We need to do a better job of bringing that innovation to market faster. And there's a lot of innovation going on here, whether it is our storage business and, frankly, also Autonomy. I mean, we have a lot of confidence still in the Autonomy software. Obviously, if we knew what we knew now, wouldn't have paid as much for it. But the underlying business, I think, and the technology is very strong. And on the PC side, listen, we call it PSG, Personal Systems Group. We don't call it the PC division because we've got to get after new form factors that people want.
So here's what I want you to do for me. Instead of all the, with all respect, instead of all the marketing gobbledygook and executive speak, tell me exactly what HP is in language that a consumer can understand.
Well, remember, HP has two customer bases. One is consumers like you and me and your family members and your colleagues. But the other big customer of HP is the CIOs at the world's largest companies. We are both an enterprise sales company as well as a customer company.
Recognizing that you do have these two customer bases, I have to point out that you didn't really answer the question of what HP is.
Ah.
HP in five words or less.
The largest IT company in the world that can provide all your needs from server, storage, and networking to PCs and
printing. You can't do it in five words.
It's hard to say just what it is in five words. But I will tell you, our customers understand what we do and they appreciate the brand name.
You say that you're in the middle of a five-year turnaround, the beginning, actually, of a five-year turnaround, year one. Is it possible, worst case, that at the end of 5 years, HP is not around as an independent company?
I would be very surprised if that was the case. This is one of the great brand names in technology. tremendous goodwill. We have customers who want us to win. And the reason is they don't want to live in an IBM-only world or an Oracle-only world or a Lexmark-only world or a Dell-only world, and they want us to succeed.
I can't help but notice that the job you, in essence, applied for before the HP job, that is to say being governor of California, looks a lot more fiscally promising right now. I mean, we're talking about we're talking about budget surpluses here, and you guys, you know, you're having some tough times. Do you ever wish you had it back to do over again?
No. I will tell you, I think HP is in actually quite good financial. You know, many people say, you know, kind of like you're implying that this is a not a good financial situation. I just need to reiterate, we generated $10.6 billion worth of cash in 2012. We have $120 billion worth of revenue. This is a very big, profitable company.
Are you underperforming, though?
Absolutely. You know, we are not satisfied with our performance. It's taken a number of years for HP to get into this situation. It's going to take a little time to get out.
Meg Whitman, CEO of HP. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
HP shares today, by the way. Oh, you don't want to know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're in that stretch of Thanksgiving week where you hear a lot about free turkey giveaways from local businesses and nonprofits. And with the economy not what it might be, people are lining up to get whatever help they can to put a traditional Thanksgiving meal on the table. Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji reports now from the Wealth and Poverty Desk.
Thousands of people are lined up in South Los Angeles for a local business's annual turkey giveaway.
An hour and a half, I've been standing in line.
An hour and a half? How about you?
2 hours.
So do you think it'll be worth it once you get to the front?
Yeah.
Jamie Hope, Iran Knox, and Andrea Benavides say it's been fun standing in line and cracking jokes with strangers. Benavides came with her dad, Ozzy.
Has the economy affected your family?
Oh, yeah. We're barely surviving.
Ozzy Benavides is disabled and says he can barely pay the bills with Social Security, let alone buy a turkey.
Who knows what we would have done? Ham sandwich, maybe.
Jackson Limousine in South L.A. has organized this turkey giveaway for 30 years. But it almost didn't happen this year because donations were low until the last minute. Across the country, in Lawrence, Massachusetts, Julia Polanco says her nonprofit, Food for the World, is having the same problem. Last year, they had 2,000 turkeys donated. This year, just over 1,000.
And we started giving them out at 9 o'clock, and like by 12:30, we were already done.
Polanco says she's giving away chickens now because it's cheaper.
You know, because I would rather see them with a chicken than no turkeys at all. You know, at least they have something to eat. And I feel proud because, you know, I'm able to help someone.
Julia Polanco blames the economy for the low donations. And turkey prices are up this year by a modest 3%, according to the Farm Bureau. But everyone I spoke with waiting in line for their free turkeys in South L.A. said they would be just as happy if they got a chicken. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
The oil boom out in North Dakota has created tens of thousands of new jobs with good wages pretty much in the middle of nowhere, which means the people who take those jobs have a price to pay, leaving their families behind in return for a chance to save some money and maybe pay off some debts. Independent radio producer Todd Melby is in Williston, North Dakota, for a year-long project he's doing that's called Black Gold Boom. His family, as it happens, is back in Minnesota without him. We're airing a series of Todd's vignettes of people and scenes from the North Dakota boom. Today, another guy who's living away from his family.
Y'all ready?
Brian Martindale.
What?
It's almost like high school sports, honestly. Like the crew you work with, it's like you're with them 24/7. Even right now, we're all off. We get together, do something, play basketball at the Veterans Center. We did that basically all winter. We'd go down there and throw the football around. So, I mean, like I say, it almost feels like you're 10 years younger than you are being out here. But honestly, like I say, I can't wait till it's over and go home.
It's been the first 10 yards. I know football.
The hardest thing for me is being away from home. The house itself isn't that big a deal. I can deal with living in the camper and everything, but missing my wife and kids is the biggest thing. Like I say, the money out here is good, which is why I'm here, you know. I mean, kind of on a 2-year plan to pay off my house and go back home. I always wanted to be a dad, I guess. I mean, I had good parents growing up. Family means a lot to me, so I always wanted to be a dad. So now that I've got kids, I just love it that much more. One of my biggest reservations about coming out here was the time away from the kids, and I never wanted them to feel like I wasn't there. And you hear stories all the time about kids that feel like they were abandoned by their dad or because he was busy at work and all that, and I didn't want that to happen. So, I mean, whenever the kids know, you know, whatever's going on, even if it's the middle of the day, if they want to call, they can call and talk to me. So, you know, if it's just that they're happy because they rode their bike today or something, you know, I mean, I want them to call and I want them to know that they can, you know, and I don't want, you know, as close as we are, as me and my kids were before I left, I don't want that to change for when I go back, you know.
How often do you talk to them?
Every day, at least once a day. I mean, at least say goodnight to them every night. You know, if I don't talk to them, if I've got time between runs during the day, you know, and I call my wife and chat with the kids for a couple minutes, you know, just ask them what's going on. I mean, even if I'm out on the road, I'll get a call 8 o'clock, 8:30, you know, just to say goodnight and I love you and all that. So every day, never miss it.
Todd Melby's project, it's called Black Gold Boom, is an initiative of Localore and the Association of Independents in Radio. Coming up,
most of us familiar with the term gentrification know that part of the classic model of it often turns on little bohemian creative class types.
Gentrification in Joshua Tree. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so here you have it. The Dow Industrials gave back 7 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 12,788. The NASDAQ was unchanged, 2916 at the bell. The S&P 500, nearly flat, 1387 is the number you're looking for there. Pulte Group rose 5.3% today as the Commerce Department said home building in October hit a 4-year high. KB Homes up 3.4%, Lennar 3.5%. Hewlett-Packard shares, we mentioned those, yeah, crashed 12% after HP wrote off most of that $10 billion autonomy acquisition. Intel was downgraded and fell 3.6% as it began a search for a new CEO. Heinz was off 2%. The pickle maker expects, yes, I guess it is a pickle maker, isn't it? Because I think of ketchup all the time. Expects nearly a quarter of its sales to come from emerging markets this year. Another food maker, Campbell Soup, also spilled 2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.66%. Come on, Heinz, ketchup. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The folks that make John Deere tractors will report earnings for the last quarter. We'll find out if they were able to plow right through a slowing market overseas and manufacturing problems at home. And for turkeys, it's a day of thanks. President Obama will pardon the national Thanksgiving turkey. Just don't mention Thursday. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, as pleasant a place as Paris can be, there are some rumblings the French economy might not be all that. Moody's downgraded the French credit rating yesterday. It wasn't entirely unexpected, but it was still unwelcome, which prompts us once again to ask this question.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
For the answer, we go back to Sophie Petter. She is the Paris Bureau Chief for The Economist magazine. Sophie, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So I imagine this downgrade is being met by an extremely Gallic shrug, right?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think they're
really
feeling very defensive at the moment, the new government. It's not that new. It's been in place 6 months now. And I think that there's a sense in which not a week goes by without some form of sort of criticism. We've had the IMF criticizing France. The Economist itself has been pretty critical. I mean, thing and another, there hasn't been a week without some form of outside view on France that's been negative.
We should remind people what The Economist has done. Your cover most recently was a bunch of baguettes lined up to detonate like a bomb, and the headline was "The Time Bomb at the Heart of Europe." That's a little harsh.
It was a provocative cover, as you know, The Economist sometimes does. You know, the cover was harsh, yes, but the analysis was reflecting what is a very serious situation. There are a lot of very serious concerns about France. So I don't think, although our cover, it's true, was provocative and hasn't been taken well in France, I have to say, the analysis, I think, was balanced and severe because the situation is severe.
Once you get out of the corridors of power, though, Sophie, and onto the cafes and the sidewalks in Paris, is this on people's minds?
I think that the feeling that there is a real crisis out there is on people's minds, and it's not felt so much in terms of spending or in the shops or going out to the cafes. It's felt in terms of job losses. That's where every time there's a downturn or a recession, French unemployment rises, and it rises very fast, and factories close. And one of the problems that you have as an employer in a business in France is that when there's a downturn, you're faced with a very stark choice of either sort of stumbling on until there's the company almost goes bust, or you have to lay off employees. And you have to do that at a huge cost because of employment protection.
Do you think there is buyer's remorse on the part of the public, having now chosen Mr. Hollande and not liking the medicine?
No, I don't think so, really, because one of the reasons, I mean, in a way, this is a president who was elected by default. One of the reasons he was elected was because people had had enough of Nicolas Sarkozy,
right,
the previous French president, and there was really an extraordinarily hostile feeling towards him. People had had enough. I don't think yet it's a question of regret about the change of president, but it's perhaps there's some reservations about whether this government is up to the job.
Yeah. Sophie Petter with The Economist in Paris. Thank you, Sophie.
Thanks for your time.
Next time you're out and about at a playground or maybe a high school football game, take a good look at the grass, would you? If you and the kids are lucky, it's real. Increasingly, though, it's not. A lot of schools and parks are installing artificial turf because it's easier to maintain. Does not, however, mean it's safer, as Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
When Carlos Torres takes his kids to the park, it's not a carefree excursion.
I can't enjoy going to the park. I can't enjoy going to the schools without looking at like a slide and wondering if there's too much pitch to it or if there's a head entrapment or anything like that.
Yikes. Torres isn't crazy. He used to be a playground safety inspector. Now he's an environmental health manager for the Los Angeles Unified School District.
Hi.
Sorry to disturb you.
That's okay.
Thank you very much.
I met Torres at an early education center in Lake Balboa. The kids are 2 to 4 years old. We pause to watch them sitting in rapt attention while the teacher reads them Chicken Little.
The sky is falling.
But what I came here to see is outside in a small fenced playground.
And we're taking a look at the artificial grass that's here that we have here for the kids to play on. And
yeah. The original turf on this 5 by 15 foot patch was removed after lead was discovered in fake grass. The lead, it turns out, was used to make the grass greener. Exposure to lead can damage organs and the nervous system, especially in young children. The school district sued the synthetic turf manufacturers in 2008. They agreed to eliminate all lead from their products. But now there are other concerns about artificial turf. Before we get into that, though, you'll need to know a bit about the history of fake grass. In the 1950s, the Ford Foundation wanted to provide children with more outdoor play surfaces, so it partnered with the chemical company Monsanto. In 1964, they developed the first artificial turf field for a school in Rhode Island. They called it ChemGrass. 1 year later, ChemGrass was installed at the Houston Astrodome and renamed AstroTurf.
It was like playing on a rough carpet with very little resilience.
Rick Doyle is president of the Synthetic Turf Council. He says the first AstroTurf was just a thin layer of carpet, sometimes over cement. Athletes hated it. But engineers soften the surface by lengthening the blades of fake grass, or FRAS, another ill-fated product name. In 1997, the industry solved the cushioning problem, crumb rubber.
And between the fibers are recycled crumb rubber, which is recycled from used auto and truck tires.
This is the stuff that raised new questions about safety. Amy Steffen has 3 boys who play soccer and lacrosse on artificial turf in Great Falls, Virginia. When she first heard about the use of recycled tires, she started doing research.
It really disturbed me because I also had looked at what are actually in tires, and that I knew that there was data that showed that the tires yield a whole lot of toxic materials.
Stefan read that some landfills classify tires as toxic waste. She wanted to know how a material could be regulated as toxic and be used as a play surface for children. Other parents wanted to know, too. And here is where we get into dueling studies. Rick Doyle of the Synthetic Turf Council cites an EPA study that found crumb rubber safe. But public health toxicologist David Brown, with a nonprofit Environment and Human Health, says the EPA study tested only four fields.
It wasn't possible to generalize from that data to what a human exposure might be.
Brown did his own study in 2007, which tested 12 fields and found traces of harmful chemicals. But Brown says his study was also too small to be conclusive and recommended a moratorium on crumb rubber until further studies were done. A few cities have banned the use of recycled tires in playgrounds, but the future of artificial grass looks bright. As home construction picks up and school funding increases, industry revenue is expected to grow 12% a year over the next 4 years. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
For most of us, even those of us who live in Los Angeles, the desert Southwest is an easy place to forget about. Automatic lawn sprinklers and air conditioning have a way of doing that. But in his new book about the American desert, about what it means and how it came to have such meaning, Ruben Martinez says we would do well to pay a little bit more attention. His book is called, appropriately enough, Desert America. Ruben, thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure, Kai.
Why did you go to the desert?
I was on one of those healing pilgrimages. I had gotten in a world of trouble. I was working as a journalist in Mexico City and was lucky enough to have a book advance. And I had spent the entire advance and didn't have a word written. And I was past deadline. I was looking to heal from addiction. And I had some friends that had started kind of like a little art colony in the village of Joshua Tree, California.
Yeah.
So I made the journey.
Joshua Tree is a place that most of us, my guess, would be know for maybe one or two reasons. First of all, you too, right? And the album, The Joshua Tree.
Exactly.
If you know the military, you know 29 Palms, the huge Marine Corps base out there.
Largest in the nation.
And it's a little cognitively dissonant, those two things going together with each other.
It is. But it's kind of, it's almost easy if you're the tourist to camp out for a night or two up there among the massive otherworldly granite yeah. boulders, and you feel like you're on another planet. But if you spend a little bit more time there, and if you go into the town and you go off the main strip, you start seeing that other desert, that the military desert, which is endlessly troubling. And yes, those two realities are side by side out there.
And it's a reality that economically changed while you were there. I mean, you your first place that you rented out in Joshua Tree was what, $275 a month, $275 a month?
5 acres.
And by the time you left, there was a boom that had passed through not just Joshua Tree, but Arizona, New Mexico. I mean, it was a place of intense economic growth the time you were there.
I think most of us familiar with the term gentrification know that part of the classic model of it often turns on little bohemian creative class types, often yeah. very low rent,
yeah.
in the beginning at least, creating a little bit of buzz, moving into a neighborhood that's probably working class, maybe immigrant, and then starting to brand it as cool, hip, alternative, bohemian. And that's what started happening to Joshua Tree.
This is a very, it's a very visual book. And I'm guessing you wrote it, obviously, because you want a lot of people to read it, a lot of people who haven't necessarily seen the desert Southwest. And as a guy from originally the East Coast who didn't really understand what the American desert West was like until he got out here, how do you do that?
This book is trying to reveal a dark and, let's be honest, scary
yeah.
part of the desert that has always been with us. And I want people to come to terms with that part of the desert so that they can experience the beauty of the desert in a cleaner way. And I think for us to have that encounter, we have to deal with that dark side of the desert. and if you'll permit me on the marketplace to say this, to deal with the desert of capitalism. You know, that part of extreme capitalism, boom and bust, which is a subtitle of the book, so I'm pointing in this direction. There's something about capitalism in the desert that goes back to the roots of boom and bust in terms of the old extractive economies.
Yeah.
And the speculation that was the wild, radical speculation that was endemic to those periods, oil, silver, gold. Today it's natural gas, oil, fracking is occurring out in the Southwest landscape as well.
It's interesting that you have turned now the conversation a little bit to the geopolitics of it, right? Because as we come out of this election now with immigration reform way high on the agenda, I wonder if you think that now this image that you paint of the desert West might start getting some more attention.
Yes. The desert West is also the locus, of course, of the immigration wars. The demographic change that everybody's talking about at the national level, of course, started right here. Immigration coming across that border, browning California. You know, when you look out across the desert landscape, you don't see a lot of green. You're seeing a lot of shades of gray and brown out there. And so brown is a human part of that landscape as well.
Yeah.
The desert, I think, is asking us to live another way, environmentally, politically, and humanly.
Ruben Martinez. His book is called Desert America, Boom and Bust in the New Old West. Give it a read. It's a good one. Ruben, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, a warning to Congress from the guy who invented the term fiscal cliff. Yes, Ben Bernanke gave a speech in New York today in which he said, among other things, that worries about said cliff are already starting to affect the economy and that, perhaps more troubling, the Fed can't really do all that much about it. Get your act together is what he was saying, but he was more polite about it. Congress, by the way, home for Thanksgiving. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 7 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ ended right where it started, ditto for the S&P. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know where to find us tomorrow, I think. Yeah. This is APM.